Don Sen, Ahiosko. My name is Beverly Lightfoot. I'm from the Moosomin Reserve from Saskatchewan. Like to sing a song, the Woman's Warrior song. Pierre Martini made that song, and she's from Mount Currie. So in honor of all the women, and if any women would like to come up and stand with us, we'd really like that. So again, it's a Woman's Warrior song.
We would now like to hear from Christine, and Christine is with Sisters in Action and Solidarity.
I just want to say that it's with a certain sadness that I'm here to talk to you about two of the groups that I'm a part of, one of which is Sisters in Action and Solidarity. Other years, it would have been Brenda Blondell here talking to you at the Prison Justice Day rally, and she would have represented SAS as well as various other groups that she was involved with and played an active role in, and in fact co-founded. But Brenda, as you've heard from others who are remembering her today, died this year, this summer, after a really long struggle with multiple illnesses. And I have to say, it was a really feisty struggle right up until the last few weeks when she decided that she'd had enough. But if she were here, she would have inspired you. And what she'd have inspired you to do is stand up and take action, whether that be by collaborating with one of the groups she was involved in, or like-minded groups here with slightly different focuses, or just as individuals. So I've got some big shoes to fill here, and whether or not I can do what Brenda could have, I'm going to talk a little bit about the two groups that she was involved in and extend an invitation to you on her behalf to join us in that work. But just before I do that, I want to read to you something that was written for the latest issue of The Word Is Out about Brenda, and it's in the issue 7 of The Word Is Out. Brenda was a co-founder of the collective that edits and produces that newsletter, and we're really missing her. So this is in memory of our sister in struggle, Brenda Blondell. For those who knew her, Brenda's passing brings a deep sense of personal loss. She had a vibrant personality. She loved to laugh and always had a good story to tell. Meeting Brenda was like meeting an old friend. She could make you feel as if you'd known her all your life. Brenda was a lifer who did her time both on the inside and on the outside, on parole. Her generous nature led her to care greatly about the well-being of others, sometimes to the detriment of her own situation. Brenda was active on the inside, first at P4W, where she shared what she knew about life with those around her, and as a contributor to Tightwire publications with those further away. After her release, Brenda continued to struggle for the rights of prisoners. She was on the board of directors for Strength and Sisterhood, CIS, and worked on presentations to the Canadian Human Rights Commission's investigation into systemic discrimination against women in prison. Later, as a member of Sisters in Action and Solidarity, she did peer support with women returning to the community. Brenda also advised the Human Rights in Action Collective, Women on the Inside. Brenda's spirit touched many lives, both inside and outside of prison. Her community involvement extended beyond prisoners' rights activism. Part of her parole condition was to attend NA for 6 weeks. Once her mandatory sessions were completed, Brenda continued to attend meetings for another 2 years, as she felt that sharing her story helped others make it through tough times. As a founding editor and contributor for The Word Is Out, Brenda will be dearly missed by all of us in the collective. Her courage and strength will continue to be an inspiration. So, just a word or two about SAS and the Human Rights in Action Collective. First, SAS is a group of women who have all done time, and what our aim is to make sure that women who get out of prison are able to stay out once they get out. There are lots of obstacles in the way of that, and those can be really different for different women, but chances are that somebody in the group has gone through them, and we can lend a hand with whatever women who are coming out need help with. The Human Rights in Action Collective is a group made up of women at Fraser Valley Prison and women from the community. So we go in once a month to meet with women in medium and maximum, and we all form the collective. And what we're trying to do is overcome the obstacles in the way of their releases on time at the point that the courts would allow them to leave, and also address some of the systemic issues, the human rights violations, as the collective directs. So on Brenda's behalf, and on the behalf of all of us who are involved in that work, I invite anybody who wants to join us. We have information in leaflets on the table, and it's got our contact information, or of course you're welcome to talk to me. So thanks.
Thank you, Christine. Terry Howard is a prison outreach worker, and he's with BC Persons with AIDS Society.
The prison outreach program at the BC Persons with AIDS Society is a program that provides support, education, and advocacy services to prisoners living with HIV all throughout the province. We do education, we provide support and advocacy issues, but in a nutshell, the program consists of myself and Mae McQueen, who just turned 83 this year and has been volunteering with this program for the past about 15 years now. And we're a dynamic duo where we go into prisons and we visit with the male and the female prisoners throughout BC, and Mae provides the hugs and I provide the information. So, Mae McQueen is a treasure that is certainly somebody that we'll cherish for hopefully another 20 years or so. When I first started doing this prison outreach program about 8 or 9 years ago now, HIV and AIDS was something in the prison system that stigma was very high. The fear of being in close proximity to somebody living with HIV was such that we often saw people beat up and sometimes even killed for having HIV in prison. So that in itself became a very difficult situation to provide support and service, because when we went into a prison, it was always a fine line as to whether we were going to blow the confidentiality of someone who needed the support from us, and also with them living in a situation where if other people in that prison setting knew that they were living with HIV and were double bunked with them or triple bunked with them or living on a unit where there was someone who was ignorant of HIV, that could have some serious physical consequences. I'm happy to say that in over the last 8 or 9 years, through general education of the public and through the education of staff and on some small part my efforts of educating prisoners about HIV transmission and also with hepatitis C. Most of the people that we provide service for have hepatitis C and HIV combined. But through the general education, that fear and stigma of being in close proximity with someone with HIV is no longer there. Unfortunately, though, nowadays, there's as big an evil, I think, as the fear and stigma of living with it, and that has become apathy and intolerance. Now, when we deal with people in prison, we don't so much have to go in and try and convince people to provide the services, but when I go and I try and advocate on a prisoner's behalf that they are mandated to require or mandated to receive the same level of health care and support that they would get on the outside, I'm often met with comments like, well, just because someone has HIV doesn't mean they need special treatment. So the pendulum has swung full back the other way. And that's a sad situation. One of the things that I have noticed over the years that May and I have identified as one of the biggest gaps in the support service that we provide is around release planning and trying to provide for prisoners when they get out of prison. And I'd just like to share with you a very short story and a true story of a prisoner that I picked up from prison myself about 2 weeks ago that I think really illustrates the frustration and the difficulty and the challenges that someone who's trying to get out of prison and stay in the community and not be in a cycle of continual in and out of prison, what they encounter and how difficult and how stacked the deck is against them. So about a little over 2 weeks ago, one of the fellows that is in the Abbotsford complex, at Matsqui complex, he was getting released, and we'd been working with him, I think, for the past seven or eight years. He was up for release and quite excited about it, was telling us right from the get-go that this time he was going to stay out. And so we provided him with a lot of support. He was a very high-needs prisoner. His medical health, his physical health was quite frail. He has advanced HIV disease and has addiction problems and also a history of mental illness. So this is somebody that I feel should never have been incarcerated in the first place. Most of the crimes that he had received a lengthy federal sentence for were things that he would have been much better served for in the community, in a facility that was equipped to handle the challenges that he faced. In any case, as he was getting released, I insisted, and he'd asked that I be on his what they call a treatment team meeting, which was taking place about a month before his release. And I was so happy to be able to go into the institution, and it wasn't without a few fights and a few conversations with staff in order to try and accommodate me into the prison, that I was able to attend his treatment team meeting. And in that meeting, where I met the healthcare providers, his social worker, his release planner, his institutional parole officer, and was able to put a face to all of the people that he'd been working with over the last 4 or 5 years at this particular institution, and they were able to actually see me, a community worker who was going to be providing support for him. That single act changed the attitude of almost all of the staff that we encountered while working with this one individual. And it was astounding to me that just that simple act of being present and saying that I would advocate for this person and that I would be his support system when he got out of prison, that made all the difference in the world as far as them doing the work and the job that they are actually paid to do. So often when people are getting close to the release date and getting near the time when they're out, they just fall through the cracks because the staff in prisons are overloaded with cases. They've got too many people on their dockets. These prisons are filling up at an alarming rate, and they're not getting more staff. And so people are often released with little more than the money that they have in their savings account. And they don't have a place to go. They don't have a place to stay when they get out. And nobody's going to take them in. And very little support services when they get out. So it occurred to me that, you know, this was someone that we could actually try and make a difference with. So I made a commitment to him that I would actually physically come out to the prison the day that he was released, and I would pick him up. And that's when the gong show began. It was quite an incredible experience, and I have to say, one where, I mean, over the last 9 years, I've certainly learned a lot about human nature and seeing people in a prison setting. And people, my friends and my family, often say to me, well, you know, you must see the most horrific things in prison. And I say, yes, I do, but it's not from the prisoners. It's usually from the staff and the apathy and the behavior that they display towards people who are incarcerated in prison, who they treat like livestock. When I went and picked him up, I was met at the door. I went down to the unit where he lives, and pretty much everyone in the prison system knew there that he was getting out that day. And we walked over. Fortunately, because I had been at his treatment team meeting, all of his medications that he was going to need and all of his finances were in order, and they were ready for his release that morning when I arrived. I arrived at 8:15 in the morning because he wanted to get out of there as soon as he possibly could, and everything was ready. I was met at the release area of the prison, and an officer dumped 4 cardboard boxes about yay size with all of his personal effects into a rolling garbage can, basically. And he wasn't allowed to leave from the principal entrance where I was told I had to leave from and where I would come in from. He was actually with his personal effects in this rolling garbage bin. He was wheeled to the gate where the trucks and the sheriff's vans transport prisoners. And I had to go through the principal entrance, come out, and wait on the other side of the gate for them to unceremoniously open the gate and literally dump the 4 boxes of his personal belongings on the other side of the gate. That in itself, if that wasn't enough to set me off, I mean, my friends and my family tell me that I'm an incredibly patient person, but at this point I was already ready to lose it. And I think because I was there and someone else was there, he displayed an amazing amount of patience, and we loaded his personal effects into the car and we headed downtown. First stop was his parole officer, who fortunately was quite a reasonable person, and said, you know, you play with me straight and I will play with you straight. You come and talk to me when there's problems and we'll work it out. So I left there feeling a little more hopeful. Unfortunately, in the 2 weeks prior to his release, I had not been able to acquire any accommodation for him. The one thing that he said to me when he was getting out and I was helping him plan his release and where he was going to stay was that he did not want to be in the downtown Eastside area because the addiction and the draw to the neighborhood was just too great for him to resist. The temptation was going to be too much, which I felt was smart on his behalf. And so I tried to find him some accommodation outside of that particular area, but still in the downtown area, because the only thing that he wanted to do when he got out was to hang out on the beach and take a walk through Stanley Park. So unfortunately, I called every hotel, I tried numerous facilities. He did not want to be in a supervised facility, and he did not have a condition of his release where he had to be in a halfway house or a supervised facility. So I tried to find him an apartment, and in the end I had 2 options for him. One was a hotel and one was a rooming house. And I felt pretty good that we were going to be able to take him from his parole officer to the hotel and check him in. Got to the hotel. They took one look at him and they said, well, where are you from? And he said, Abbotsford. They said, oh, well, we don't take people who are from the Lower Mainland. And I said, well, you know, that might have been helpful had you told me that on the phone when you said you had room and lots of room and just show up and you'd be able to take him in. And they said, oh, I'm sorry, that's our policy. And end of discussion. So again, the frustration level starts to go up. So we went up to the boarding house where the second option was made available, and they wouldn't even consider him being a part of this boarding house or moving in without a credit card. Now, I'm sure it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that a prisoner who's been incarcerated for 9 years is certainly not going to have a credit card and is in no immediate hope of getting a credit card. And unfortunately, I wasn't able to provide a credit card for him to secure that place myself. So we headed back downtown. I thought, well, at the very least, we can drop off his personal effects at my office and we'll keep them safe until we do find him someplace to stay. And the whole time I'm thinking to myself as we're driving, fortunately in a rental car, with these four boxes, what would he have done at the gate of the prison when they opened the gate, gave him a bus ticket with these four boxes of his personal effects? I mean, I have no idea how he would have made his way downtown. Probably had to get a locker, probably use some of the cash that he had in hand in order to pay for that locker for who knows how long, and then try and find some sort of accommodation. So we got back to my office, we unloaded all of his personal belongings, I made sure that he got his medications out and a change of clothes and all the things that he was going to need for that day. And again, because this is a person with some fairly high needs, I doubt that he would have had the wherewithal to do that on his own had someone not been there to remind him, okay, these are the things that you're going to need, we're going to lock the rest up and keep it safe for you. And for the rest of the day, we drove around and we tried to find a place for him to stay. We went to 9 hotels and we ended up in the downtown east side. And I said, well, maybe we should go to the ministry office and, you know, ask them if they have any advice about places that are in this area, at least that would be available. We went to the ministry office, so he was already had his welfare check in hand. He had part of a support payment. He's already applied for his disability and received his disability before he got out, so he was set. But the office worker there would not see him until he actually had a place to live, because you have to go to the office that's closest to the place you live. So if you don't have a place to live, then a welfare office doesn't want to see you to help you find a place to live so that you can come to that office in the future. Catch 22. But the woman did realize the circumstances and told us that the only place that she knew of was the Brandy's Hotel, which is unfortunately almost on the corner of Main and Hastings. And that, sadly enough, is where I had to drop him off that day. And fortunately, because we've been able to keep in contact for the last 2 weeks, he is still out and he is still trying. Our office is still trying to find him a place to stay that is a little more permanent and that is out of the downtown east side area. But I think that that just illustrates, I mean, at that point when I dropped him off at that hotel, my frustration was so high that if I had encountered a government worker, I'm sure I would have punched their lights out right then and there. And how he maintained his cool through all of this, to me, was an absolutely astounding feat, and I just don't know how he did it. So that, I hope, will spur some people into action. I know that through the efforts of Working TV and Shaw Cable, who this program actually goes out, and I have had a lot of negative feedback when I've gone into the prisons by the staff who have viewed this program. They do get a lot of airplay. So I know that the word out there, if any of the people that work in the prison system hear this story, the thing I would like to leave with them is to at least try and have some compassion. Realize that that's a human being that you're working with, and that is a person that has needs. It's a person that needs your assistance, and they're not there being punished by you, and it's not a penal institution anymore. Corrections is supposed to mean rehabilitation, and corrections facilities should be trying their very, very best to reintegrate people back into society when they're getting close to their release date. So thank you very much.